I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, thanks for downloading this Kermit on Film podcast. This week we're joined again by Jack Howard. Jack,
hello.
How you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. Okay, so I'm particularly excited about this week's discussion. What are we discussing this week?
We're going to decide. We're going to form a definitive list
of
what is the best Steven Spielberg film.
Okay,
we're not going to define a definitive list. We're going to argue.
We're going to argue. So we've chosen three each, right?
Yes.
And then we'll sort of have a juke match. So how do you want to do it? Do you want to alternate?
Like,
you
know, I think we should just have a chat.
Okay, fine.
And I'm just interested to know what your choices are. And okay. I've also got like a thought of what I think your choices will be.
Okay, tell me what you think my choices would be.
I think Jaws will probably be number one.
Yes.
I think that maybe E.T. might be in there, but maybe something like Schindler's List and maybe Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, two out of three.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so, go on. Fine. So, Jaws is a work of genius. I think there's no question about it. I remember really clearly going to see Jaws, the ABC Turnpike Lane, when it first came out. I'd read the book, the Peter Benchley novel, because it was that period when posters for movies would be up for a long time before the movies came out. The soundtrack albums would be in shops a long time, and every single railway station would sell the
right.
paperback. It was the same with Exorcist. It was the same with Taken to Pelham 1, 2, 3. You'd read the book by the time you saw the thing. So I'd read the book of Jaws, so I knew, you know, the story. But nothing could prepare me for the opening scene. I still think the death sequence at the beginning of that film is one of the scariest things I've ever seen. And I literally, not metaphorically, I literally thought, I am going to lose control of my bodily functions. I am
right.
going to suffer the indignity of wetting myself in a cinema because I am so scared.
Come on in the water!
Take it easy. Take it easy.
And then after that, the rest of the film isn't a horror film in the same way. The rest of the film is a, you know, is a thriller, and it's about the relationship between the people. And I was interested in the way in which the script had very cleverly changed some of the themes of the novel. The novel is very much about, you know, Ellen having the relationship with Hooper, and that's why Hooper has to die. And in the film, Ellen doesn't have a relationship with Hooper, so Hooper lives. I know people say, oh yeah, but it's to do with the fact that the shark ate the cage. And yeah, it is and it isn't. There's a narrative reason why Hooper can't die, because he hasn't had the relationship with Ellen, therefore there's no sense in him dying. And every time I go back and look at that film, what I love about it is the joy in it. You know, I made a documentary about The Exorcist, which was directed, produced by Nick Friend-Jones, who had made a documentary about Jaws, and we've had conversations about this, and Nick's talked about going back and seeing the remaining relic of the orca, because there are bits, there are various different versions of the boat, but there are bits of it still washed up around the areas of Martha's Vineyard, and you can kind of go out to it and touch it, and it is like the phrase you used was, it's like the true cross, you know, it's a movie that you want to live in, because you want to live in Amity. You want to live in the, you know, in the company of those people. I love everything about it. I think it's just great. It's a brilliant example of how a score can solve all those problems for you. So absolutely, it is a timeless piece of cinema, and I think it's genuinely terrifying.
No one's arguing with that.
E.T. phone home.
phone home. He wants to call somebody.
What's all this shit?
ED phone home.
My God, he's talking.
Oh.
ET phone home?
ET phone home.
ET, I think, is wonderful because I'm a rank sentimentalist, and I love the fact that that film, firstly, it's, you know, it is Spielberg's most personal film. It is a film made by somebody whose parents broke up when he was young and who never got over it and who, you know, felt out of place and felt awkward and somehow puts all of that personal stuff into this story about a space alien being left on Earth.
Yep.
And everything about it is wonderful. And I had this, when I was making the Alien documentary some years ago, we went to interview Carlos Rambaldi because he had worked on Alien and he had also worked on E.T. And in his studio, there was the E.T. model, the animatronic version of the model, and it was lying on its side. And I said, what's that? He said, oh, well, there's an anniversary coming up and, you know, they want me to make it work again so they can put it in a Virgin store or something, you know, the original E.T. And I said, is that actually it? He said, that's the one that we used. And it was literally lying like E.T. looks after they find him in the river. You know, you want to start his thing.
And I want to try and save him.
You do. And it was, and I said, it's amazing. Can I touch it? He went, yeah, it's fine. I've got to, you know, he said, because it's all polymethylcellulase, whatever it is, it's got to be redone. And I reached out, and I'm not making this up, this is true. And I reached out to touch E.T.'s finger and it fell off.
I was expecting magic. I thought you were going to be like, off. And it lit up.
Literally fell off.
I'll be right here.
But the third one is AI. And I'm almost inclined to say that it's the one that I feel the most personally attached to because it's the one that I really didn't like when it came out. And my wife, Linda, who's a professor of film, is writing about Spielberg, saw AI and said, you know, you have to see that film again. And I said, why? She said, I don't like it. She said, no, but you don't understand it. You've got it wrong. You've misjudged it. And I had seen it in New York when it first came out. And I just thought it was all over. And I had these real sort of film critic-y, snobby opinions about Steven Spielberg doing a Stanley Kubrick film. You know, how dare he? When, of course, it never really was a Stanley Kubrick film. It was always really going to be a...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how true is that? Well, that people obviously think that it's him finishing Kubrick's work.
Yeah, basically, there's a long version of the story, but the short version of the story is that Kubrick had worked on AI for a long time, various versions of AI. In fact, I know somebody who at one point was employed by Kubrick to see whether it was possible to build a robot child for use in the film. Because Kubrick's big problem was this. Kubrick shoots lengthily, okay? And the problem that they had was Kubrick making a film that relied on the performance of a child in which the child didn't grow up during that. Now, obviously, The Shining and Danny and all that we know about. But it was an issue because it was such a technical thing. There was no way that Kubrick was going to be able, you know, he's going to have a problem. He was going to start making AI and the kid was going to stop being the kid. So he did, this person I know was sent off to research for a year whether it was possible to make a robot child. And they came back and said, no, it's not. And that was, okay, fine. So that, of course it's not. I mean, I could have told you that. But, you know,
without all the research.
In Stanley Kubrick world, you go and get somebody to go and prove that it's not possible to do.
I'll take his money. Why not?
And Spielberg and Kubrick were passing it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And Kubrick said to Spielberg, this is a you movie, this isn't a me movie. And what he meant was, you do this stuff, right? You make films with kids. You understand, you know, you shoot fast. And Spielberg does. I mean, despite the fact that Jaws ran over schedules, Spielberg could do it. And you look at AI and you think, okay, there is the proof that he could do it. And so I think the whole thing about it being a Stanley Kubrick thing that Steven Spielberg hijacked is totally bogus. Also, all the things that people think are Steven Spielberg are Kubrick. The thing at the end with the super mecha coming down, you know, which look like the creatures from Close Encounters, that's in the Kubrick version. So Kubrick had handed it over. It wasn't that Spielberg took it away from him. Kubrick had worked with it and figured that it wasn't a film that he could do, and Spielberg took it on. And I actually think it's brilliant, and I was so surprised when I saw it the second time around, because it's one of the things that taught me a really strong lesson, which is that it's possible to misjudge a film because of what your presumptions are about what it should be and what your prejudices are about the way it was made. And then when you see it again years later, it really affected me. I think the scene when the mother has to take her robot son, who is to that point her son, out into the woods and let him go because she doesn't want him to be returned and destroyed, is one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever seen. And there are scenes. Well, I think the Flesh Fair stuff is overcooked. You can see the kind of the echoes of, you know, of World War II and the atrocities and all that stuff in the back of it. And I do find that Flesh Fair stuff really, really upsetting. Although I think it's overcooked and hokey, I still think it's upsetting. And I think David's relationship with Teddy is brilliant. The Jiminy Cricket stuff, the way that works is fantastic.
It seems to me that you've got the most to sort of say about AI, probably because you've had such a journey with it.
Yeah, no, and that's it. I mean, it has become the talisman film for me. So to me now, I think of AI and I automatically sort of go into a sort of state of wobbliness.
Listen to me. David, listen. Now, you won't understand the reasons, but I have to leave you here.
Is it a game? When will you come back for me?
I'm not, David. You'll have to be here by yourself.
Alone?
Those are your three.
Yeah, so that's my three. So I would think that your three would be... Well, I'm assuming Jaws.
Yeah, it's in there. Okay. I haven't really got an order.
Fine. So yeah. I'm assuming that one of them would be Jaws. I'm inclined to think that one of them would be Close Encounters.
Nope.
No, okay. And
I actually watched Close Encounters again recently, like within the last few months, and realised that I think it's a bit all over the place. Like, I think it has, well, like...
Depends which version, but I mean...
Right, okay. Well, I didn't even know there was multiple versions. Okay. Right.
How long have you got?
But I thought that it was...
There's the long version, which is actually shorter than the short version.
Right,
which is,
right. I thought it was just a bit strange that, you know, the family stuff I felt was a bit weird, that you're... you know, I can't remember specifics, but like, it's just, I just found it all a bit like dramatic and over the top and a bit strange sometimes. And is somebody cheating on somebody in the film or something like
no,
that?
No, the main part of the story is that Dreyfus is going mad,
yeah,
and that his family cannot understand why he's going mad.
Yes.
And he becomes completely obsessed with building the mound, and he builds it out of potato, and then he builds it out of mud. And his wife, and the whole point about the film is, in the end, he leaves his wife and children and goes off in the spaceship. And Spielberg said later that he would never have made that film once he'd been married and had kids, because he just felt that it was wrong that the father just abandoned.
That's exactly, you know, my... Yeah, that's... So I was misremembering, but exactly what I was like. That's so a bit of a strange arc.
Yeah, no, and it is. I mean, that's what's so weird about it. It is about somebody who says, bye!
Yeah.
You know?
It's a little bit like Four Weddings and a Funeral, like ending up with the...
The wrong woman.
With the wrong woman. It's like, you've made the wrong... Yeah. You made the wrong film.
Okay, so my third... It's not Hook. Please tell me it's not Hook.
No, it's not.
No, like, you do love Hook.
Hook has a place in my heart, specifically because I loved Peter Pan as a child, and I was the right age to enjoy Hook. And none of the weird stuff where all of a sudden Julia Roberts becomes a full-grown Tinkerbell seemed weird when I was a kid. Yeah. But you watch it as an adult now and you go, this is mental.
Okay, so have you gone for Bridge of Spies?
No. My three...
Okay, go on.
Would be
you're more mysterious than I thought you were.
Jurassic Park.
Oh, of course, stupid me. Of course, your age. Of course, it's
Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, brilliant choice. Very good choice.
And Jaws.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that Jurassic Park, in the way that Jaws is not about a shark, it is not about dinosaurs.
No.
It is about fatherhood. It is about becoming ready for fatherhood. It is about a relationship with another generation and playing God and how that parenthood is a form of playing God and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And there's some wonderful imagery in that I cannot unsee now when I watch the movie, all the stuff, all the parallels between the car and the footprints and the egg, and then the footprints are very just similar parallels that clearly Spielberg is obsessed with fatherhood.
Well, we've just been making this program about disaster movies for Secrets of Cinema, and we put Jurassic Park in there because it is a disaster movie. It's you know, it's a classic, you know, look, man built this brilliant thing, what could possibly go wrong?
Everything,
you know, the rides start eating the tourists. But of course the main arc of it is Sam Neill, who doesn't like kids, gets to like kids, and that's the absolutely classic disaster movie arc. The person who's a bit not very great gets into the upturn ship or the fiery bill, whatever it is, and discovers that there is more to life than what they thought of at the beginning.
It's a lot of little things in it that I like. I like at the beginning when he's on the way in the helicopter and you see his practical... he can't figure out the seatbelt. So he just ties them together. And you're like, oh, I know the sort of man he is.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that you wait so long for the T-Rex to come out, and when it does, it still holds up today, and it's still, you know, I watch it and I turn the lights off at that moment. I want to be in full darkness for that sequence of the Jurassic of the T-Rex
the escaping. Velociraptors in the kitchen is
incredible,
terrifying.
It is still terrifying. But what I mean about the T-Rex bit is that all of a sudden he goes, no one cares about the geography. So he's playing with geography the entire time, and he makes sure everyone knows where everyone is. But then all of a sudden, where the T-Rex came from is all of a sudden a steep drop, and he's making you feel disoriented and weird about the place. And I just like the fact that no one cares, and he just needed it to be a steep drop now, and so it just is. I like that sort of stuff. I like that it's a constant tension machine. It just is, even like when it's not to do with dinosaurs, like the fence being turned on.
Yeah, that is a brilliant sequence.
It's amazing
because she is about to electrocute them. Yeah, exactly.
And, but it's just characters who are in completely different places are still having an effect on each other's lives.
And the glass of water shaking is an earthquake moment. Isn't it? I mean, that is just brilliant.
And
that's
all of Jeff Goldblum's speech around the table where all the projectors are on, and just being like, you didn't stop to think if you should do it. All of that is all the stuff that you want to fast forward through as a kid, but then you realise as an adult, oh, this is the meat. This is the stuff that's interesting.
The Secrets of Cinema about science fiction. At one point, we had a draft of it that literally began and ended with Jeff Goldblum doing that speech, because it's so much of science fiction is about that. You know, you were so eager to see whether you could, you didn't stop to think whether you should.
Yeah.
And I remember being in the cinema. I saw it at the Empire. I think it was the Empire or the Odeon in Leicester Square. When I first saw it, and it was on the front cover of Sight and Sound magazine. That was how seriously Jurassic Park was taken. Sight and Sound put it on the front cover, and that speech when Jeff Goldblum does that, it was just, you kind of felt like, okay, I can take or leave the dinosaurs now. But then when the dinosaurs come there, oh, that's really good. That's really
amazing, good, and dinosaurs. It still holds up.
John, inherent in what you're doing here, genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
It's hardly appropriate to start hurling generalizations.
If I may, I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You know, you read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't start to think if they should.
And you know, another little moment that I've just been reminded of is the ice cream scene.
Like, oh yeah.
It's just things like that, like putting that in a movie of that scale, you just,
but when everything's fallen apart and he's sitting there eating ice cream
and the ice cream is melting, and it's very obvious metaphors, but also like it's character affirming stuff, and it's good. It's like really like settling for a moment to see how people really feel about what's happening in the moment. Yeah. And it wasn't afraid to like do horrible things like finding an arm and really being scary.
The arm is very Jaws though, isn't it?
Yes, it's the bit where you find the guy in the cage.
Exactly. I mean, I was astonished that Jaws was an all audiences certificate movie. I mean, it was an A certificate when it opened over here, which meant you could watch it, but you had to have parental guidance, which meant you had to say, Mum, do you mind if I see a film in which a shark kills people?
Even Jurassic Park is PG.
Which is astonishing.
I know.
But that's Spielberg's genius, isn't it? He's making those movies as edgy as they can, but people don't swear in them.
Yep.
That's the key
There's
thing.
There's only like one swear word, I think, in Jurassic. Yeah. I might be wrong, but like...
But it's not a sweary film.
It's not. So, you know, you've got Sam Jackson going, hold on to your butts. and that's the iconic line.
See, the Tyrannosaur doesn't obey any set patterns or park schedules. It's the essence of chaos.
I'm still not clear on chaos.
It simply deals with predictability in complex systems. The shorthand is the butterfly effect. A butterfly can flap its wings in Peking, and in Central Park you get rain instead of sunshine.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so look, Jaws and that, I think we can completely agree on.
Because I think that Jurassic Park is Jaws turned up. That's sort of how it feels
Yes, I would agree.
It feels like a polished version of what Jaws is.
Yeah, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't immediately say that. So in the same way as I have AI, you have Catch Me If You Can.
I think Catch Me If You Can is perfect.
Okay, so go.
I think it's Leonardo DiCaprio's best performance.
Yes, I would agree.
I think he's incredible in it. I just love the journey of all of it. I find it all incredibly charming and fun and sad and tense. I love the beginning when you, again, it's Spielberg, you are introduced to how Leonardo DiCaprio as a 16-year-old boy feels about his father. Just the pushing shots on him and how much he admires him. And he's the first person to clap when he says the two mice are stuck in a bucket of cream. Like when he's doing that speech and he's the first person to clap, you go, I know exactly what your motivation is for this film now. It's to impress your father. You want to be like him.
And your father is Christopher Walken.
And your father is Christopher Walken. So the big shoes to fill.
Don't lick it.
And just the you know, it's all so beautifully set up. The single takes that aren't showy of him finding out that his mother is cheating on his father, and she's in the background, I'll make you a sandwich, or do you want some money? And then keeps bringing her, and it's just letting it hold on how horrible that must feel. And then, you know, seeing how amazing, like, of a performer he is straight away when he goes in and pretends to be the substitute teacher.
Yeah. Quiet down, people! My name is Mr. Abagnale. That's Abagnale, not Abagnale, not Abagnale, but Abagnale. Now, somebody please tell me where you left off in your textbooks. Excuse me, people, if I need to ask again, I'm going to write up the entire class. Take your seats!
Chapter 7.
Will you please open your textbooks to Chapter 8, and we'll get started? Excuse me, what's your name?
Brad.
Brad, why don't you get up here in front of the class here and read conversation number 5.
Love that. I love it so much. And then, like, his father finds it funny. Like, it's just constantly reminding characters feel about the decisions that are being made.
There is great joy in it. The scenes in which he's wrangled his way onto the airlines, and there's these fantastic sweeping shots of him walking across the runway, you know, with sort of hordes of stewardesses behind him.
It's set to Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, which is wonderful, because it's like it's knowing and wry about the setting. I love
who are you here to pick up? And the guy gets out and holds up a sign that says handwriting. And it's just, it knows that it's being tongue-in-cheek and it's being silly, but it's also treating it with real stakes and real emotion.
And of course, the fact that it's a true story makes it all the more a stop, because, you know,
the structure of it is incredible. At the beginning, showing him on the game show knowing that he gets out of it alive, and then intercutting that with him at the prison, showing immediately you get a relationship between Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio where he cares about him.
Yes.
You're already introduced in the first few minutes to the idea that these two are more than just criminal and cop, and it's not in a sort of Robert De Niro and Al Pacino way where they have a mutual respect. It's a genuine he cares for him and wants to get him, make him well.
Yeah, and of course the fact that the narrative then means that they do end up working together, because all the way through it's clear that Hanks is, I mean, he's impressed by how this is being done, despite the fact that he detests that it's being done. And you kind of want them to get on. You want them to be friends. But, I mean, I when I first saw it, I knew nothing about it. And, in fact, I think that I'd been told it was a comedy, because it had quite a comedic poster, you know, with the arrows, the kind of Saul Bass-like design, and the characters running
the silhouettes.
It. Yeah. And it's, it almost looked like a sort of Pink Panther-style romp.
And the opening credits are definitely like that.
What surprised me was that it's much darker than that. There's all that levity and all that fun and all that brio and all that just being excited by, you know, the world is an exciting place, but there is a lot more going on under the surface. And what I hadn't expected when I first saw it was that when it gets under the surface, you're talking about that scene with the mother, it's all there. It's not just surface froth.
And I think that the reason why it can be so light and fancy free when it wants to be is because you are following a teenage boy living out a fantasy of I can be James Bond at the age of 17, and I can be all these different I can be an airline pilot, I can be a surgeon, and I can fool everybody into thinking that I am something that I'm not. And when it begins that way, you think, oh, this is fun, and then it starts to be like, no, this is taking its toll on him, and he's bit off more than he can chew. And I think that it does that arc and sees that through in a very, very smooth way. You don't really even notice the change. So when he starts to feel the pressure, you start to feel the pressure as well, because at first you're just having fun with him. I think it's just brilliant. I think there's nothing in it that I don't like. I love the way it's shot. I think it's very different to the way, you know, Spielberg uses all his old tricks, but I think it's also very different to the way that he usually shoots things. It doesn't specifically immediately feel like Spielberg.
Because
the handheld is more often used. He uses a lot more sort of frantic cuts than he usually uses, I think. Even the score is not very traditionally John Williams. Okay. And here's a question for you, actually. Yeah. How much do you think that John Williams' scores make Spielberg movies Spielberg movies? Because I would argue that even though there are quotes that you can take from all of his huge successes, I think that if you say Jaws or Jurassic Park, you know, those types of big movies, or E.T., the first thing that people will do is think of the music. What do you think?
Edgar Wright said this really interesting thing, which was, he said that he thought the reason that the John Williams scores were so important was, what's the last score that you can sing? And the answer is, it'll be a John Williams score.
Harry Potter.
You know, okay, fine, but you know, it's Williams. I mean, I suspect that people would sing, closing a Spielberg. I mean, Harry Potter is singable, but of course,
The last score that I can think of that's new.
Well, actually, Harry Potter's called da 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 da. Yeah. But even if you've said something, sing a recent movie score, right?
It probably, if I'm going to pick a recent movie score, and it's because it's obviously so ingrained in pop culture now, but it probably would be the Avengers theme.
Okay.
Because I think that's been like hammered in now. Okay. That they want people to remember that one. But I think the last great memorable score is Harry Potter.
Yeah, okay, fine. So it's Williams. It's not Williams and Spielberg, but it's Williams, right? So the point is, Williams writes singable scores, and particularly when Williams is working with Spielberg, he writes themes that are the film, okay? So, all that stuff, I think that's what you mean. I don't think it's true of the later Spielberg movies.
I think
people can sing Schindler's List, I know that sounds like a... But you can. You know the violin pieces. That, you know what I mean? But if I said to you, tell me the theme from Ready Player One.
Yeah, no.
You couldn't.
No.
If I said, tell me the theme from Bridge of Spies.
No.
No, fine.
And to be fair, obviously, they haven't had as long, which is why, you know, when people talk about the new Star Wars scores, and they're I can't immediately remember Kylo's theme or Rey's theme. It's like, give it a bit of time to sink in. Yeah. You've had 30 years to remember the other
ones. Okay, well, fine. Well, sing me the theme from Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, you're right. I can't.
So the point is, I think that when people say the William Spielberg thing, they mean a particular bit of William Spielberg. Yeah. They mean the bit which is, you know, when Raiders, you know, the Close Encounters, that's what they mean.
Oh, my God. No, I need to change my third one.
Well, oh, why? You're going
to
do Raiders?
It needs to be Last Crusade.
Oh, okay, fine.
It needs to be Last Crusade. Because Indiana Jones to me feels like a completely separate thing. I forget sometimes that it's Spielberg.
Well, there we go.
It has to be Last Crusade.
Rather than Catch Me If You Can.
Rather than Jaws.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You're going to say that Last Crusade's a better film than Jaws?
I'm not going to say that definitively.
You're insane.
I'm just going to say that, like, for me, if I'm going to pick a movie to watch, I think I'd rather watch Harrison Ford and Sean Connery argue with each other.
Junior?
Yes, sir.
It is you, Junior. Don't call me that, please.
Well, what are you doing here?
I came to get you. What do you think?
I think I'm going to have to go for that.
Clinically crazy.
I don't know if that's true. I think that I grew up with a different...
But what's brilliant is you didn't throw out Catch Me If You Can, right?
No. Because,
and actually, well done for not doing that, because that would be like me throwing out AI. But you didn't throw out Jaws. You've literally thrown out Jaws.
Yeah, yeah. Over. I think that it would be a very close fourth. But I think that in terms of my enjoyment, I would say that it goes Jurassic Park, Catch Me If You Can, and The Last Crusade.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I do. I think it's that.
Wow.
And maybe
I haven't been shocked in a long time. I
wonder
shocked.
If the listeners would be more shocked by me picking The Last Crusade or you picking AI.
I think that people will know that I've got this thing for AI because I've you know, it's
you've had a personal journey with it.
I have, and you know, I am often guilty of oversharing. I think I have talked about this personal journey a lot, but I could literally right now I'm about to go off and see a film that I'm very excited about. But if you said to me, I'll actually, you can put that on hold and I'll show you AI, I would watch AI again.
Right.
AI has now got, it's got its hooks in me. It's got its hooks in me, and it's so much, I mean, this may sort of relate to, you know, you and Last Crusade. So much of it is to do with your own investment in
totally.
The movie, the times that you've had with the movie.
I grew up being a huge fan of James Bond, and my dad said, here's a film that James Bond is in, and it's a bit like a Bond film, but, you know,
yeah.
he's a bit like a cowboy,
yeah.
you know, something like that. And I get to see James Bond and Indiana Jones hang out, and it's got all that amazing humour in it that has influenced me so much, as, you know, because I make a lot of comedies. It's got that bit in it where he's like... Sorry, I'm going to find this hard to explain. But the bit where he's like, he's out of the country, he speaks a million languages. With any luck, he's got the grail already. And it's like this huge pushing shot. And it just smash cuts to him going, does anyone here speak English? And it's just that amazing sense of humour that as I've carried into all the stuff that I've made. Mm. And, you know, it's this big adventure movie. It's so good. And it's not really about anything other than the adventure. It's not like I can point to it and be like, Jurassic Park is not about dinosaurs. It is, obviously, but it's about fatherhood.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is kind of about a relationship between a father and a son, but it's not like the theme.
Yeah.
It's about finding the Holy Grail.
And obviously, it's very hard for it to live up to The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull,
obviously.
In which Shia LaBeouf reminded us just what a wide range he has.
I think that everyone's first favourite film by Spielberg is obviously Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Does it even worth mentioning?
No, exactly. I mean, that's top of the... Okay, so to bring this to a conclusion, there was a clear winner, which was that we both had Jaws, and now you've thrown the most almighty spanner in the world by coming up with Indiana Jones.
There's got to be a boat reference there that we can do.
Yeah, we are going to need a bigger boat. have you seen AI recently?
I haven't. I'll make sure to check it out again.
Okay. I would like you to watch AI again, because I will happily watch Catch Me If You Can, because I think that's the one that you seem the most excited about.
Yeah, because I think Jurassic Park for me is like standard one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, and then I think Catch Me If You Can is just perfect. Like I think just as a, because Jurassic Park is like this big adventure thing that I grew up on, but Catch Me If You Can is just this surprising,
yeah.
What, you know, you were surprised when I said it, like it's one of those ones that people sort of forget about.
Yes, I forgot about it in the same way that you'd forgotten about Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I mean, wow. Okay, all right. But I think it's safe to say that the ones that we are both personally most invested in are Catch Me If You Can
yep.
and AI.
So I definitely will check out AI again.
I will definitely check out Catch Me If You Can again. I can guarantee you that on my video shelf at home, I have a video of Jaws and a video of Last Crusade, and I am never choosing Last Crusade over the possibility of watching Jaws again.
It's so funny, isn't it? Because like, I don't think...
Not funny, Jack. It's actually quite scary. And a little sad.
I don't think that I would have expected or even thought to go to AI ever if you hadn't have said, oh, give it another chance. Because the fact that you're putting it in your top three of, like, you know, and neither of us have mentioned Saving Private Ryan, which I think is obviously amazing.
Well, it's half an hour of a brilliant movie followed by 2 hours of a not such a great movie, but...
It's 3 hours long, which is why I don't really ever revisit it. Yeah. And I don't really don't... I feel weird just watching 25 minutes and then stopping.
Yeah, because that, I know, that's like watching the first 25 minutes of Clockwork Orange and then going, oh yeah, but then after that, there's the other stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it is there is brutal stuff in Saving Private Ryan, but the thing is, it's so front-ended that you know, after once they're off the beach, the rest is like, where do you go from?
That's here? All anyone ever talks about, obviously.
Yeah. Which is a shame, because there is actually other interesting stuff in it, you know, but including the shot of the mother kneading bread in the house when the car arrives up the thing, which is one of Spielberg's most, are you getting this? it's she's a good person and bad news is coming.
Stephen, get offset.
All right, Jack. Well, I look forward to you coming back. I might give Last Crusade another look.
It's really fun.
If you watch AI, I'll watch Last Crusade.
All right, deal. All
right. Okay, fair enough. Thanks a lot. So there you go, that was me talking to Jack Howard about our top three Spielberg movies. Please send us your suggestions of your top three favourite Spielberg films. You can get in touch through Twitter, I'm at @KermodeMovie. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please remember, do subscribe. Thanks for listening, keep watching the skies.